Into the Fold is a podcast of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is a strategic grant maker on a mission to transform how Texas communities promote mental health in everyday life. We're based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, everyone. This is Ike Evans of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The month of July is Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. In recent years, there has been a welcome shift toward greater awareness of men's needs for mental health support. However, there's still plenty of evidence that men and boys continue to be pushed toward behaviors that erode their well-being. This may be especially true for men of color. A recent study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that men 18 to 44 years of age who had daily feelings of anxiety or depression, that only 26.4% of Hispanic and non-Hispanic Black men went in for mental health treatment. This is in stark contrast to non-Hispanic white men, 45% of whom sought treatment. In a previous podcast, episode 34, Mental Health and the Black Student Athlete, we spoke with Dr. Ryan Sutton, director of the African American Male Research Initiative at the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. Though the focus was on sports, our conversation did touch on issues of great weight for Black men as a whole.
I think a large portion of the racial trauma is this deficit narrative that is attached to Black males and thereby dictates the way people perceive us, the way people respond to us, the way people interact with us.
More recently, our own Dr. Octavio N. Martinez Jr. wrote an op-ed titled, How to Make Real Mental Health Changes for Men of Color. Here's a quote. Men and boys of color are well aware that they're seen as problems first and people second. For those who live with mental health challenges, this experience is intensified. We can change this dynamic by illuminating the relationship between men's personal self-care and well-being at the community level. Men and boys can be newly invigorated by seeing the connection between good mental health and their higher aspirations for themselves, their families, and their communities. To help us understand how to begin to address such issues, I am joined by Dr. Calvin Kelly, counseling psychologist and dean of students at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. We're seeing through the lens of African-American men, but we hope that what we say resonates more broadly. Dr. Kelly, we're excited that you can join us.
Ike, thank you very much for having me here today.
In my time with Haug and as a podcaster, I've had numerous opportunities to reflect on my identity as a Black man, both in general and as a longstanding member of a community that has a complicated racial history. Mm-hmm. As a man of color who's both a behavioral health professional and part of academia, what extra things do you find yourself needing to do just for your own well-being?
Great question. First, I'd like to start by saying there is no such thing as a monolithic Black or male of color experience. Even at my age, I want to be clear that this is a journey. It's a journey of ongoing discovery. Like most men of color, I'm also trying to uncover, unravel, and refine, if you will, my own identity and what exactly does it mean to be a Black man in this ever-changing place that we call America. For me, my health and well-being, like most men of color, is produced from an extremely intertwined set of relationships between behavioral, social, and structural factors that impact us across our lifespan. So it's very interesting. The word that I really caught or that really caught my attention as you were reading or asking your question was the term extra. Because I do think there are things that I do that are extra, but may not be extraordinary, if you will. So one of the things that I do to take care of myself and my well-being is I work out at least 6 days a week. For me, that's very important. Because staying active is just as good for the brain as it is for the body. And we've got to be mindful of that. You've got to do something with that stress and that tension that your body is building up whether it's in your workplace, whether it's in your family space, you've just got to release that energy some way. You've got to get it out of your body. I also make social connections a priority in my life, especially face-to-face. I know we live in a day and age of technology and people are texting right. each other, calling each other on the phone. I am that personable person where I want to go out and see someone face-to-face and have that conversation. I've also learned that I've got to keep my stress in check. That's hugely important. And so I do this by making leisure a priority in my life. And what I mean by leisure is I love reading a good book or going to see a great movie. So those things are very important to me. And I would also say is that you've got to be mindful of what you put into your body. What are you eating? Because we know that there's a lot of research and a lot of data that says that certain foods will adversely impact our mood and our disposition. So we've got to be mindful of that. And finally, getting a great or good quality sleep is hugely important. So really allowing the mind to rest and not to be invaded with thoughts or distress when you're trying to be at rest.
Yeah. Okay. So I do not work out 6 days a week. So I'd sure love to know how you do that. It'd be an offline conversation. But thanks for that. So our focus today is on minority men. I think, though, that word focus mm-hmm. should give us pause. So whenever men of color are under the microscope, it seems that there's a tendency to focus entirely on deficits,
right?
Even though that's not our whole story. And so what can you tell us about the nuances of speaking to men of color about mental health so that we're not reinforcing the stigmas we hope to challenge?
Yeah. What I'd say to that is deficit-driven approaches are definitely, they definitely reinforce the stigmas that we're looking to address in our society. When speaking to or working with men of color, for me, the first thing that I do is I honor their humanness. And you talked about what Dr. Martinez op-ed said, and I just thought that was hugely important, especially for individuals in my profession, that we not see men as problems or see them from this deficit model, but we do recognize them as humans and as people who are coming in to share and to tell their stories. And we've got to honor that there's power in their stories and when we don't listen to their stories and we only focus on the problem that they're presenting with, we miss the person that's sitting across from us or the family that's sitting across from us. And we've got to remember that should a man of color choose to engage with a lay person or to lay out and discuss that they're experiencing mental health issues or challenges, this is a male who has decided to allow themselves to be vulnerable. And we've got to respect that vulnerability and we've got to nourish that and really take that to heart. In addition to my work in my private practice, as well as my role at the institution as an administrator, I also have the opportunity to teach behavioral counselors how to work with people, but specifically how to work with men of color. And here are some of the things that I've realized. You've got to establish that rapport, that trust. You've got to have a solid relationship with that person. So some of the, when we talk about the nuances, we've really got to focus on that relationship. That is hugely important that this person recognizes that you are really seeing them, again, as a person and not as the problem that they are presenting with. I generally do this by spending time talking with the individual about some neutral topics. I want to know about their work life. I want to know about the hobbies and the things that they're involved in, the things that they're doing outside that make them happy, that make them a person and make them feel alive. I also recognize that some men, but not all, and I want to be clear about that, may be embarrassed or reluctant to self-disclose emotions such as anxiety or depression and things of that nature. So one of the things that I do, again, and I talked about this, is to normalize that behavior. I may self-disclose and let them know that I have struggled with certain things. I do that not to put myself out there, But I do that to normalize the behavior and to help them to recognize that they're not the only ones dealing with a particular issue of, or concern, and that it makes them feel very normal as they're talking about what it is that they're presenting with and what it is that they want to discuss. Finally, I also recognize that we as men are often socialized to be goal-directed. So one of the things that I want to do is I want them to leave the session or the meeting with goals and things to do so that they clearly understand that there's work happening outside of the counseling session and that the expectation is that they're coming back ready to work and to be engaged all over again.
Okay, so on that theme of, you know, taking a more strengths-based approach, what are some norms or behaviors characteristic of men of color that offer some protection against mental health challenges?
Yeah, right. You know, men of color are first and foremost extremely, extremely resilient. When you look at our history, when you can't negate that history, you can't dismiss it, you've got to contextualize it and you've got to recognize the power that's in that history. And oftentimes, I think even we as men of color forget how important that history and the things that we have endured and that we've experienced are. So the things that I think that the strengths that I think they bring is that for many of them, they have developed a zest for living. They love to have fun, and you know they recognize that laughter is very important. Learning the ability to deal with stress, which we all encounter stress, and being able to bounce back from it again, that sense of being resilient is hugely important. For all of us in our lives, we've got to find a sense of meaning and purpose. We've got to figure out for ourselves. And for a lot of men of color, they figured out, what is my purpose? What is my true meaning of being here? Is it just to work and no play? Or is it just to whatever, however we define that? Mm-hmm. It's very important that we find purpose in all that we do. We've got to find a balance between work and play. The World Health Organization just released that they are now adding burnout as a diagnosis.
Right.
Because people are not taking care of themselves. People are working hard, but they're not releasing that energy. They're not playing hard. They're not finding outlets to let some of that go. And so those are some of the things that I think in particular the strengths that men of color bring to the table that they've got to recognize that they have inside of them and that there is no magic bullet. But those things in and of themselves can help us to live more fulfilling lives and can help us to overcome a lot of mental health challenges that we may encounter.
Okay, so I guess turning now to vulnerabilities, which you've already said some things about, I think many are starting to get the message that men need to be more proactive about their mental health. But what more needs to be said about the mental health of men of color, especially?
You know, I may sound like a broken record when I talk about this. However, I think it bears repeating. Mental health or psychological well-being makes up an integral part of our capacity as men to lead a fulfilling life. And I just talked about leading fulfilling lives. This includes the ability to form healthy relationships. This includes the ability to study, to work, to engage in leisure activities, and to make those day-to-day decisions that we have to make for our lives. And for me, I think one of the most important things for us is that there are approximately 46 million people in the United States who identify as Black or African American. Of those 45 or 46 million people, 16% of those individuals, almost in 1 in 5, have a diagnosable mental illness in the past year. That's over 6.8 million people that we're talking about. Data shows that the majority of those individuals live somewhere in the South. So when we talk about or discuss vulnerabilities, we can't dismiss the fact that men of color, that with men of color, there is some residual around from a number of historical adversities that we've experienced, like slavery, race-based exclusion from health care that we've all, or not all, but some of us have experienced in the past and many of us experience to this day. We've got to realize that there are vulnerabilities around social and economic resources that also impact our mental health and well-being. One of the things that I think that we've got to do to overcome these vulnerabilities is that we've got to claim a new national narrative that supports mental health being just as important as physical health. What I say to the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis is that you need to have a physical, you need to have a mental health checkup yearly, just like you would have a physical checkup. And I think if we began to shift that narrative and began to engage more in those conversations, we can begin to move the needle around the vulnerabilities that people are experiencing.
Okay. So what role do community settings play in reaching men of color? Because in my experience, people are willing to have this kind of conversation, maybe if it doesn't look so much like the kind of place where they would have right. that kind of conversation. And do you have any examples of community settings contributing to the cause?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think we don't do well is that we don't take advantage of the natural spaces that men of color find themselves in.
Right.
If we were to take advantage of those spaces. And it happens where we don't think about it. I was in the barbershop the other day getting a shave, and it was just really interesting that somehow the conversation turned to R. Kelly. And as the conversation turned to R. Kelly, the issue of mental health, without calling it mental health, surfaced. And we found ourselves engaged in a lively discussion, but no one ever termed it or called it mental health or mental illness. But the conversation was around how to have healthy relationships with people of the same and opposite sex. And so one of the things that I really appreciate about Austin is that churches have really decided to become involved and engaged in these conversations. And so I've had the privilege and the honor of being a part of a number of churches that have sponsored events around the city, that have talked about mental health, that have sponsored conferences to talk about mental health. I've been a part, and I am a part, places and spaces where groups are now happening in churches. You know, churches are spaces where men come together. But we come together for spiritual healing, and we don't realize that we have to heal our overall whole being. And part of that whole being is not only the spiritual and the physical, but it's also our mental makeup. So having those conversations in churches and spaces like churches is hugely important. I also want to add, Ike, that we got to start where it really begins, and that is as early as we possibly can in the school system. In the classrooms, we've got to transcend the classroom beyond just the learning spaces that they typically become. And we've got to transform them into spaces of dialogue. Those are real opportunities for us to engage a young population about well-being and how to take care of yourself and how to deal and address issues around bullying, around masculinity, around just well-being. So we got to have that conversation. We've got to invite fathers into those spaces with their boys, with their daughters, so that they too can be a part of those conversations and begin to understand, you know, how to be involved, how to support their children, and how their being well will impact the wellness and well-being of their children.
Okay, yeah, it's kind of awesome that you mentioned R. Kelly. Because he might be highly relevant to my next question here, actually. So These days, when discussing the mental health of men, there's a temptation to join the larger conversation around toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
R. Kelly might be an example of that if anyone is, right?
Right.
And this is a concept that some find helpful while others find highly problematic.
Right, right.
So are there ways of easing men into that conversation that you have found to be effective? Or do you think it's you know, either too much trouble or kind of a deviation from the productive conversation that you would like to have, or what?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Ike. Let's take a look at the term toxic masculinity. I believe that in part of the controversy surrounding the term has to do with the fact that over the past several years, toxic masculinity has become a catch-all phrase or explanation for male violence and sexism in our society, first and foremost. The term's appeal, which distinguishes toxic characteristics like aggression and self-entitlement, have become highly commercialized and politicized. I found it interesting that about a year ago, maybe a few months ago, Gillette releases a commercial where in the background is talking about toxic masculinity. Now, we're talking about a company that's involved with a number of products, but their number one product for this commercial was around shaving. Right. And the whole issue of the advertisement was about how men can engage other men. It was about how men can stop bullying and stop violence in their communities. And so it was a really interesting take on toxic masculinity and how anyone at any point in time can intervene and stop violence. The other political side, the other political piece, I should say, has to do with because it has become politicized, you have one side of the aisle that is alleging that toxic masculinity is an attack on manhood itself. And on the other side of the aisle, you have one group saying that we've got to detoxify toxic masculinity to the point because it is the pathway for that group to gender equality. Now, what does all of this mean? Your question to me was, is this something that I address directly? I do. Because what I do is I take it through the lens of what I call the man box.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know what the man box is. And we've heard of it, whether consciously or unconsciously. At some point in time, all of us have had our man box socialized to believe, A, real men don't cry. We don't cry openly, nor do we express our emotions openly. Except the only emotion that we're allowed or we're taught that we're allowed to express openly is anger. We're also taught that real men don't show weakness or fear. And so all of these things go into creating this toxic masculinity that we're talking about here today. And they all fit into this thing that I call the man box. I think that the only way that we can overcome the man box and toxic masculinity in our society is that we've got to engage in those conversations head on. We've got to talk about what does it really mean to be a man of color or a male in our society? Does that mean really that you have to dominate someone? Does that really mean that if you're not sitting around with a group of men and you're not having a conversation about sports, then you're not really a man? We've got to, and I do it in my own personal sessions, I engage people directly in those conversations because if we don't, we're missing the whole point.
Okay. Thank you for that. So that does it, I guess, for our conversation.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. Dr. Calvin Kelly, we really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ike, thank you again very much for having me today.
So we have done a number of past episodes that are very relevant to this conversation. So for our listeners, if you want more related to this topic, I have included links to several resources in the episode description. Three of them are previous podcasts featuring Dr. Kevin Coakley, a former member of the Hawk Foundation National Advisory Council, and Dr. Ryan Sutton, whom I previously mentioned. He is director of the African American Male Research Initiative at the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement here at UT Austin. In episode 10, The Threat of Stereotypes, Kevin Coakley and I talk about the issue of stereotype threat, particularly as it shows up in the lives of African American professionals. We already mentioned episode 34, Mental Health and the Black Student Athlete, so please check that out. And then finally, in episode 65, The Past Does Matter, a look at post-traumatic slave syndrome. We joined up one more time with Ryan Sutton for a conversation about post-traumatic slave syndrome, which explores the important connections between historic oppression and present-day trauma. So you'll find links to all of this and more in the episode description. This is Ike Evans. Thank you so much for joining us.